I ended up with 17 felonies. I had 30-something. Whew. Now I think I'm considered a 17-time felon.
Do you remember getting shot?
Oh, yes. I wake up 3 days later. I'm in Vanderbilt Hospital as a Jane Doe. Their uncle got killed on our front porch. Drug deal gone bad, right? Then I ended up getting pregnant while being addicted, and I had my second child. I can be a roadmap to their success, knowing that the hardship that I had, that they don't have to follow suit. I got a call one day to go back to court. Always been scared because I believe the police forgot to arrest me for something.
Right?
I just believe they forgot.
This is Rooted Recovery Stories. I'm Patrick Custer, your host, and I am thrilled to be here with you all. And our special guest today, CEO and founder of Mending Hearts, Trina Frierson. Welcome.
Thank you, Patrick. It's an honor and a privilege for sure. I apologize for my allergies. Thank you for having me. Thank you for just spreading the word at our community at large. It takes a great person and a special person to acknowledge not only Mending Hearts, but things that are happening in the community, people coming up from adversities, facing barriers. So thank you for the work you do. Definitely mission driven.
Absolutely. Well, passion, mission, and vision, I feel like our hearts are united.
Yes.
Absolutely. And being a Nashville native myself, I have been such an admirer and fan of what you have done and are continuing to do to cultivate good, not only in our city, our community, but in the lives of those who are recovering like us and who have yet to find the doors.
Yes. It's, you know, I first and foremost thank God, who's my source of strength. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I came from a background of a praying mother, mm-hmm. and I'm forever grateful. She continued to pray for me. And even those moments, Patrick, when I thought that she was giving up hope, mm-hmm. she never gave up hope. You know, she didn't like my choices, mm-hmm. but she never kicked me to the curb. She always poured in positive thoughts and affirmations to me, even in my destructive patterns. Mm. And so I think that is first and foremost the reason I'm still here, through God, right? But, you know, the truth of the matter is, Patrick, like many of us, we went through hard times through our bad choices. And, you know, we didn't come out on the right side, you know. And some people would think that I was insane for saying what I'm about to say is that, you know, I want to thank my justice system. Mm. I want to thank them for stopping me, arresting me, and putting me in an institution because it was that institution that also poured into me and gave me a shot of hope in order to walk this path of life that I'm on. And so I'm forever grateful.
That's beautiful. So before you got to the institution and before your mama was saying, I need to pray for Trina.
Yes.
What happened?
Oh my God. Who knows? But I do know that my mom raised 6 kids as a single mom. Mm. My father passed when I was 6 years old. And you know, what I remember is this single mom working 2 jobs. It was 6 of us. I'm the youngest of 6. I watched my brothers and them, you know, go to school. And, excuse me, eventually coming up, Patrick, in 11, 12, and 13, I watched them smoke marijuana. But back then, it was, you know, alcohol, marijuana, but it was so social. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't this epidemic, pandemic that we've seen lately. And it was casual, right? And you didn't see people just slumped over, falling over. The worst you would see is a drunk man walking down the street, sitting on the side of the curb, but you didn't see things that you see today. Mm-hmm. And so I came up in that era. And also, I think I was 14, and my sister gave me my first joint, right? She said, don't tell nobody, right? And that's the first secret, right? Besides the other ones. But, you know, that was one of the things that I think I harbored, I held on to. And it didn't affect me. That joint didn't affect me. You know, I had an older friend that would go down to E&W Market, which is the market that Oprah's father owned, and it was right down the street. And he was a guy that, you know, as kids, I could go to the store and my mom could call down there and said, hey, put a can of beer in there, but also give him some lunch meat bread and I'll pay the ticket later. That's what the kind of guy he was. And so you were trusted to walk from the corner store back to your house. But my sister gave me that first joint. It didn't faze me. I came up playing basketball in my elementary, junior high, and high school. I even got a scholarship to college.
Wow.
And I went for a year and a half. Freshman year, went back for my sophomore year, and found out I was pregnant, right? And yeah, right. And so one of the things that I encountered along the way, you know, I smoked a little weed, drank a little drink, you know, after basketball games. When you get into high school, you know, you always got a little half pint stuck in the gym bag.
It's college.
And so that was the most I ever done. In college, I think, was the first time I seen cocaine. And I was offered some. And I don't know, at that time, it just didn't appeal to me. And I turned it down. So I seen it on the table, never experienced it, seen the white powder substance, walk past it. But after I got pregnant, had the baby, the most, again, I would ever do was smoke marijuana, drink wine, a little beer every now and then. Wasn't a big alcoholic, right? Well, after I delivered the baby, my mom and my siblings was just, they didn't want me with this guy. And I just couldn't believe it. And I was like, he's handsome, he's buff, all the girls want him, he want me.
Was this the same guy that you had the baby with?
Yes.
Okay.
And so one of the things happened is that they knew his history. I didn't do my homework.
No.
And so he had been incarcerated. He'd been in the penitentiary. And when he came out, he looked good. He looked like one of us, right? Mm-hmm. And my brother and them used to say, no, he's a junkie. He's a robber. He's a thief. And it's like, I couldn't see any of that. He was doing well, construction worker. And so we get in a relationship, I have the baby, and I couldn't understand the term junkie then. To me, a junkie was a person sitting on the side of the road, homeless, indigent, to that effect. That was my concept of a junkie. And so one day I came home from bringing my—
How would you define a junkie today indifferently?
You know, I don't know if I would use the term junkie.
I wouldn't either. But
yeah, a junkie today is what you see is a person fiending.
Yeah.
And it's an IV user, right? Yeah. And so that's the perception, right? Mm-hmm. And so, but as we continue to go throughout the years, the same way that the trend of drugs change, you know, back in the 60s, 70s, there was heroin, right? And then there came the marijuana. Then there came the ice. Then you got some, I forgot the dating drug that they used to use. So you had all those trends. Then came the meth. Then came the crack cocaine in the 70s. And then come the freebasing and, you know, just trend. And I think, you know, as we continue to go through this process, there is no longer the junkie, but the addict.
That's right.
You know, yes. And so I think the behaviors of our systems change just as well as the drugs do. And so that's why I don't see a person as a junkie today. But, you know, I came home that day and out of the car, a bottle of beer fell over and broke. And he was this neat freak. And I went to his trunk and I got out this bucket. It was a hospital bucket, and he kept a little broom and dustpan in it. But there was a brown bag, and I opened the brown bag, and I was so green at that time. There was cotton swabs, a spoon, a turnip, and needles. And I said, alcohol swabs, and I was like, So I called my mom. I said, Mama, Robert has this thing in here. And in its bag, and it looked like it's some doctor tools or something. And she said, girl, that's what your brother been trying to tell you. And I was like, no. So I called him. He said, oh, that's my friend's. He couldn't take it home. And so I kept it for him.
Of course, yeah.
And he has a friend that he got it from his doctor's office. And I believed the lie, mm-hmm. right? Until one day I came home and I couldn't get in my own house. And they had it barricaded. And he finally let me in. We never closed our kitchen door. Excuse me. We never closed our kitchen door. And he was locked in there with his nephew and his another friend. And finally, I bust through the door. And I bust through the door, and there they are with the needles and the turnips. And I said, and automatically it hit me, you lied to me, right? And the next thing come from my mouth is, I put the baby in a crib, go back, and I say, I want some. Stupid me, but one of the most loving, considerate things that he ever done for me and said to me at that time, in the middle of his addiction, he said, no, you don't. And he was very angry. And he said, you don't ever, ever do this, ever. And the love stupidity at that time said, well, you love me, and if you can do it, I can do it.
Right.
He said, no. And I never seen him get that belligerent. I mean, like, he was just mm-hmm. out of it, right? Mm-hmm. Angry. And so his nephew said, I tell you what, here. And so he put it in a cigarette for me. And I began to smoke it in a cigarette. Well, I'd smoked three of them before my lips got numb, right? And so I think I was smoking too much of their supply, and they packed up and left. And then the next week they did it again, and they left again. Then the next week they didn't come, but I knew where they were going to get it across the street. Mm. And so I go to purchase some across the street, and the drug dealer said, what are you doing? I said, Robert sent me. Now here's my lies. Mm. Robert sent me to get this. And he said, he knows better. Angry again. So I guess they seen something in me that I didn't see, right? And they had enough respect to know that, no, we don't want you doing this. Mm-hmm. He said, I'm going to give it to you this time, but you let him know, man, I'm going to cuss him out. We don't do this. And so I knew that he wouldn't sell me some. So I went back on the block where I knew they were selling
right.
it. And before you know it, the pattern had kicked in. I had started taking my daughter to my mama's house, and I would stay out a day or a night here and there. And eventually it started weeks at a time. And then I ended up getting pregnant while being addicted, and I had my second child. Mm. And then in the middle of that, I miscarried twice. And so in addiction, right? But prior to my second child, I had a tubal pregnancy. So today I'm supposed to have six kids.
Oh my God. What is right? that? What is that? Can you explain? Because I'm not familiar with a
tubal pregnancy yeah. is where the baby is born within your tubal.
Really?
Yes. So you got the uterus and then yeah. you got the fallopian tubes. And so the baby is born in the tubes. And so you either have to have surgery or it passes. And,
oh, my
you
know, gosh.
And so I ended up having to have surgery for it, right? And so after then, I guess the next year, I have my second child. Mm. She's born with a hole in her heart. She has surgery at 5 days old.
You didn't think it was because of?
Well, for a long time, and I thank God for the 12-step process, right? I thank God for it. Those 12 steps is not only an assessment tool, but it helps you pull off the layers, right? Of all the things you think you done wrong mm-hmm. and all the things you know you done wrong and the things that you done right, right? Yeah. You get the liabilities and the assets, right? Mm-hmm. And so I was able to work that process and identify with the help of a guide, sponsorship, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. I was able to identify that I didn't have to take ownership for that. being looking at our history, I have an enlarged heart. I have a daughter, my first daughter who was born, has an enlarged heart. She wasn't born addicted. Her parent, her father, and his family members, four or five of them have had pacemakers, oh, wow, defibrillators, transplants. And so it runs in the family. Yeah. And so, you know, I thank God I got off the hook. And that's not to say that it didn't affect it, but I don't have to wear that today, you know. And, you know, as a result, you know, my son who was born later to addiction, he's healthy, no heart problems, no, you know, internal problems. And so I'm grateful for that. I've been blessed through that process, you know, and through this process of going, you know, through addiction, I'm grateful today that I was able to tell my story to my kids so that they wouldn't have to. You know, I was able to tell them that after going through this addiction process and leaving college, that, you know, I ran the streets and I got high and I neglected them and abandoned them. And I left them on my sick mom who had stage four cancer, right? I was able to tell them that the night that I got out of jail, it was the same night that their uncle got killed on our front porch, drug deal gone bad, right? And I was able to tell them that the life I live, you know, they don't have to follow it. Mm-hmm. And that I can be a roadmap to their success, knowing that the hardship that I had, that they don't have to follow suit. And, you know, I think it was my second daughter is the first time I experienced jail. And I got into an altercation with my brother. And I pulled a weapon, a knife on him, and he called the police, right? Mm-hmm. That caused me about 6 months in jail, 6 or 9 months in jail. You know, when we do things, when our behavior takes place and we take actions on unhealthy behaviors, we tend not to take ownership.
Right.
And we start blaming people.
Yeah.
And because I went to jail, I get angry at my mom because I think she ought to do something to my brother. Because he's the one called the cops, right?
Right, right.
And my mom was so neutral, and she was straightforward. And if you're wrong, you're wrong. I'm going to love you,
mm-hmm,
but I'm going to let you know you were wrong.
Right.
And I was wrong, you know. And for a long time, I resented her for not taking my side, right? But here she is at home taking care of my kids. Here she is with cancer, right?
Yeah.
And so as the days go by, she passes in 93. Right? 6 months later, that's when my brother got killed. I'm in active addiction. I am the right hand to my mother. I know all her personal business and everything. So while I'm out here in active addiction, now my mom passes, I got reasons to use.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And my brother and them come and find me and say, you're going to stop using long enough to take care of mama's affairs. So I got to stop long enough. I stop one day and I'm back out the next day, come and find me again.
Yeah.
You got to go sign mama paper so we can have his funeral. And so I'm going through all of that. And I finally get it done. 6 months later, I got to do the same thing for my brother, right? And so here I am with insanity in my life, trying to be accountable and responsible. But they held me accountable long enough in order to get those burial arrangements done. And I'm grateful, right?
Yeah.
But it took me a long time to forgive myself for that process. But again, I go back to the 12-step process. It was that in therapy that helped me get through. And so after then, in 94, right, I get shot 3 times. Drug deal gone bad. Twice in the leg, once in the private area. And I wake up 3 days later, I'm in Vanderbilt Hospital as a Jane Doe.
Do you remember the getting shot?
Oh, yes. Yes, yeah. I remember getting shot. I remember the house that I pushed my way into, the lady, I got a visual of her. I remember the apartment complex in Settle Court, right? I remember all of that. And I wake up and people are looking for me, and it's 5-6 people call asking about me, and they won't give them any information, but they take down the names. They say, do you know this person? This person is called looking for you. I was like, that's my brother and that's my friend. But the other three, yeah, I knew them, but they weren't the people that needed to know, right? Yeah. And so I get up and I'm trying to get up out of bed and I fall and I catch myself on the side of the bed. I can't walk, right? Because I'm shot twice here and once in the private area. And so they get me, I guess the alarm goes off and they come in there and, hey, you know where you at? I was like, yeah, it looked like I'm in the hospital. Like, what's, you know what happened? I'm like, no, I couldn't remember at the time, right? And so they recall and they tell me what happened. And when I talk to my brother, my friend, they kind of give me the flashback. But after they tell me, they said, we're going to let you call your family. But did you know you were 6 weeks pregnant? I said, no. It's like, yeah. They said, but we got a small problem. Where the bullet is, right? The two in the leg went in and out. The one in the private area stayed. And they said, where the bullet is lying, as the baby grow, it could affect you or the baby. And it could go one way or the other. So we need you to come back every 2 weeks. And we've got to watch this.
So they didn't take the bullet out?
No. And so that bullet didn't come out until 2016. And I had to have a hip replacement. Yes, because it traveled. It was a traveling 22.
Whoa.
And over the years, it just moved. And sometimes it would hurt so bad, I would lose my balance, right? And so I went on years for this. And so I never went back to the doctor. In my insanity, I tried to abort this baby on my own because shame and guilt, right? I've already neglected and abandoned the other two kids. Mm-hmm. I don't want any responsibility. My mom's gone. I got a sister at home who's caring for him now, but she's got mental illness, mm-hmm. schizophrenic, untreated.
Ooh.
Right? And so these are where these kids are.
Right.
But my insanity won't tell me that I need to be there instead of her. Like, it's just, hey, let's go. Mm-hmm. We're on to the next one. I want more. And so I'm thinking, like, if I can abort this baby, if I just get high, right? I done tried castor, laxatives, the whole nine. And as my belly grow, right, I'm thinking, this baby is not breathing. It's not moving no more. So, okay, well, they're going to have to take it. I know it's not going to be born. It's not going to be alive, right? And insanely, I'm okay with that at that time, right? And what happens is I get there, and I'm like 9 months, and I get to hurting real bad. I'm in a hotel room, and I tell one of my play brothers, I said, man, take me to the hospital. And I'm getting high on the way.
Mm-hmm.
All the way up until he pulls up into the ER. And they go in and I deliver this baby. And I got expectations that the baby's not going to live.
Right.
And they go out, and you know how they come out sometime and hit it on the butt to make it. And the baby never said anything. And I was really okay with that at the time. And then it goes, he go, ah! And I'm like, oh, shit. Like, and he said, it's a baby boy. I'm like, man. And so at this time, I got this baby.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to get my mind. And I got a little hope that, Trina, you need to get yourself together. Right? It goes through. And I get home, and I tell the hospital I'm going home to prepare. And I get back. And I don't come back. Right? They call for me.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you better go up and get that baby before DCS come and get you.
Yeah.
And so I go get the baby and I bring it home. And the first day, the baby's riding around the streets with me as I'm doing drugs, selling drugs, doing drugs. Then eventually, I take that baby and put it on my sister. And so I'm in and out of the streets, and I guess I get arrested on my last run. I'm incarcerated on this last time because I've had several times in and out. And I've probably been arrested, I can't even count them. I got seven. I ended up with 17 felonies. I had 30 something, but they knocked some of them down. So now I think I'm considered a 17 time felon, right? Okay. And so all from drugs, child endangerment, weapons, you name it, right? Yeah. And so one of the things happened along the way in my last incarceration is I'm in jail. I got these charges. And one of the charges that they were trying to pin on me was a murder. But the murder was my last charge. I got busted in this hotel, in this room. And there were guns laying all over the couch. And I had bought these weapons from someone. And I knew who I bought them from. I knew they probably done robbed a pawn shop, the whole nine. But one of those weapons had a body on it. And I knew the person who had been killed. And I knew who they said may have done it, but, you just didn't talk about stuff like that. Mm. And so when they charged me with this, my mom quit school at an eighth grade level, but she worked at General Hospital for 30-something years. Oh, wow. She became a supervisor, and she was just this awesome woman, right? Mm-hmm. And so one of the things she told me was, if you don't ever understand a document, if you don't never understand anything about a document, you always look at the italic print or the stuff in the box and see what's checked. And I remember that when they were offering me that charge and they were trying to offer me 30 years. And I was like, you know what? For all the drugs you found, the weapons, I'll take that charge, but not a murder, right? And so, when you're in jail, they kind of give you a bargain, try to get you a deal, send you back to jail, let you wait and think about it for a couple months. Then you go back. Mm-hmm. And so they come back and they say 15 years. And I was like, nope, not with the murder charge. They said, well, you have to go to trial. I was like, let's go to trial. And so then he goes back and he said, man, you got a good deal. This is 15 years. I said, not with that murder charge. He comes back. He says, hold on, let me go check something. He said, hey, they got you down to 8 years. He said, but hold on, let me go check something. He goes to check it because they done took the murder charge off.
Wow.
And he comes back and he said, hey, you got 8 years at 30. I said, not with the murder. He said, it's not on there. I looked at the box, looked at the italic print, because it's a couple of pages. Mm-hmm. It didn't have it on there. I said, run it, right?
Yeah.
And so prior to this, I had already been in jail. Mm-hmm. Done a 2-year treatment program. In there, I'm leading groups. I start a relapse prevention program. They're taking me out. I've got a picture. They're taking me out to the Boys and Girls Club to speak to kids and say, don't follow me. I'm in jail uniforms, handcuffed, and I'm speaking to these kids, right? And so I'm doing all this good stuff. But then when they let me out, I get out. I don't last 2 months. And I'm back in there, right? And so this last time when I get out, this is the last time when I go, no, when they give me this charge, I said, I've done the program. I taught the program. And he said, no, I said, I taught that program, chances, right? And he said, you taught chances? I said, yeah, you can call the counselors and ask them. I was a lead intern in the program. And the judge hit his gavel and said, this time I want you to do the program. Don't teach it. Don't lead it. I want you to do the program. And I went out of there fired up, mad, right? And when I got back to
that counsel, ego got involved.
What? The counselor said, just because you're kicking and screaming don't mean I got to keep you. Mm. You can either do the program or we can send you over in population. Well, if you go over in population in jail, it's just like being on the streets.
Yeah.
And then it clicked to me, Trina, if you really want to do something different, here's the time. And that last time in that treatment program did it for me.
This podcast is brought to you by Promises Behavioral Health. If you or a loved one are struggling with trauma, addiction, or mental health, we are ready to answer your questions and help you take that next step. Call our admission center at 888-648-4098. Or visit us online at www.promises.com. Our team is ready and waiting to answer the call for help.
I didn't try to be a lead in the program. I ended up being a lead, but I didn't go in trying to be a lead. So I went out, and this time something different happened for me. Through all the journeys of my treatment programs, usually when you get out of jail, they give you your white netted bag and you go down on Harding, catch the bus or somebody pick you up and take you back to your original spot where you got caught at, right?
Yeah.
Well, this time someone picked me up at Roll Up One and took me to a transitional house. Mm-hmm. And in that house were women just like me. And it was a friend there that I used to use when on the streets. That greeted me at the door, made it all so well. She gave me the guidelines and the rules. Don't do this. Trina, they're not going to give you food stamp assistance because you got 17 felonies.
Right.
So here are the food banks. And if you go to this one on Wednesday, they give you a hot meal too. If you bring what you got from the food bank to the house, that's your contribution to the groceries. Mm-hmm. You eat when we eat. And I was like, that ain't fair. We're talking about a block of butter, block of cheese, jar of peanut butter, some soup, you know, half a carton of eggs. And she said, no, it'll be fine. You're going to do that two or three times a week. And then we're going to eat. You're going to eat. And you're welcome to what we have. And I just couldn't believe that a group of women wanted to surround me and empower me like that. Then they came in and said, Patrick, here, you're going to have to find a job. I'm off on Mondays. You can use my bus pass today. And it became a domino effect. The women in the house start saying, I'm off on this day and I got 2 days. You can have my car. Another woman said, I'm off on Fridays. I'll take you to look for a job. And they supported me in a way that was just unbelievable.
Wow.
People start calling from jail and said, Trina, how you living without the fast lifestyle? I said, you ain't going to believe it. They said, you over there manipulating people. I said, no. I said, they're just pouring into me, right?
Yeah.
And they did. And I finally found the job. I lied to get my first job, Patrick. I don't advise that for anybody. It was a company over here off of 17th and West End. And it was people with disabilities. And I told them that I was I had a hard time reading and writing. And we were selling this chemical. They call, you know how they say to get the blood and the ink out? Yeah. I stole some, and I had some oil on my shoe, and it didn't get it out. And that's when the light came on, and God said, you're still lying, cheating, manipulating. And I quit that job, found another one.
Good for you.
And from there, started working at warehouses. The warehouses. I got a call one day to go back to court. Always been scared because I believe the police forgot to arrest me for something.
Right? Yeah.
I just believe they forgot.
Uh-huh.
And so one of the things happened is I go back to court. All my children, I've lost parental rights. Custody lost all of them. Because I'm out there in addiction, right? And so I go to court. Her father is there and I'm there. And I knew she was in this place. Well, he's high. And he's saying, I don't want my daughter with her mother. I don't like her lifestyle. And basically what he was talking about was my sexuality, right? Because now I'm open. I'm out. I'm living free. I'm being who Trina needs to be for Trina. Nobody else. And I am so grateful for that process. But he says, no, the judge says, well, where do you want her to go? He said, I don't know, but I don't want her with her mother. He said, well, can she go with you? He said, no, I'm on my way to get me some help. And he said, And then they talked about something else. And before you know it, the judge said, I ordered this child to her mother today. I said, whoa, 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 Your Honor. The people in the courtroom are clapping like they're grateful, right?
Yeah.
And he said, what's wrong, Ms. Rouse? I'm crying. My daughter's over there looking. And I know she felt left let down. But I was like, I live in a halfway house. We can't have children. He immediately said, when do you complete the program? I said, in about 30 days. He said, clerk, help her find somewhere to live for her and this baby. Get them some furniture so we can reunite them. My daughter is excited. Ugh. I'm crying with fear because what I don't want to do, Patrick, is let her down again. Yeah. I don't feel worthy. I've already felt like I screwed up her life. I've let her down. And one of the things that happened is I go back home to tell my roommates. They said, don't worry. We'll get one big house and we'll show you how to be a mother to her. And Patrick, I didn't have credit. It was my counselor who co-signed for our first house.
What?
My counselor. I thank God for her. She was a chief clinical director over at Cumberland Heights. And man, she gave me therapy. She took me into individual therapy, family therapy, couples therapy. She is the key to the beginning of my process outside of the institution. Man, she really helped me and she believed in me. And what she told me, she said, I don't know what the other two are going to do, but I believe in you and I know you're going to do right. And if you ever feel like you're falling short, you just call me. But my ego was too big and I couldn't let her down, right? You got somebody fighting for you.
Yeah.
So now you got to really fight. Mm. And so I never looked back. And so I knew that the job I was working at that time was $7 an hour. I knew I wasn't going to make it. So I had to start a cleaning service. And I always tell people, as addicts, we're some of the smartest people out here.
Yeah.
You know, we just didn't know how to use our gifts. And if we transfer those accounts from a negative to a positive account, if you look at it like a banking account,
yeah.
Right? And you transfer those gifts, man. Listen, I'm telling you, you can be anything you want to be. And I knew that I didn't have any trades or gifts, but I said, you know what? I cleaned for a piece of dope. I washed clothes, right? I made runs. So you think about people running errands for drug dealers, mm-hmm. right? Now you got Uber.
Right.
You can get a job.
That's right.
Listen, if you go down there and tell Joe what Bob said, guess what? That's communication. Mm-hmm. You can be a receptionist. Mm-hmm. You know, if you clean, not only do you have to go work in a hotel to clean, but guess what? You can start your own cleaning service. Mm. And that's what I did. I started a cleaning service. First job, went in the red. My partner at that time said, hey, you go get the jobs and I'll bid them. And from there, we started billing about $8,000 a month.
Wow.
And so from there, I was going back to the jails to speak and to share my stories. And something hit me. The women start calling, when I get out, will you help me? And I start tearing up a sheet of notebook paper, writing down the resources, do this when you get out.
Mm-hmm.
And when they start getting out, they would come to me. And I was like, you got to go here. And we go to meetings. And then a light bulb came on. You need to start a resource center. And it's like, I was like, yeah, I'll do that, right? So I start writing up something on paper.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah, it needs to do this. Women could get out of jail, be dropped off at the door, get clothes, food, bus passes, ID. You know, if they need to take a urine test for the PO, you know, we were there, right?
Mm-hmm.
And as I wrote the program, showed it to a friend, he said, you're just missing a house. I said, no, it's a resource. And he said, no, it's a house. Go back and read it for yourself. And I did, Patrick. Now, by this time, Patrick, I get this one child, right?
Mm-hmm.
Awarded back to me, and I don't know how. Because when you lose parental rights, they're gone.
Right.
Right? And I don't know how they did that and overturned it. But now it's a domino effect. Now I got another child coming home.
Oh, my goodness.
And, like, I got to move out of this house. Yeah. So we ended up buying our first house. Well, the first year, my partner and I, so I had two kids. We go to a little hick town over in Georgia, Blairsville. We're fighting her parents, right? We're in a biracial relationship. Mm-hmm. We're fighting her parents for her child. So now I got three kids at home, and I got one more to get myself. So this brand new little house we just bought in North Nashville, we've outgrown it.
Uh-huh.
And so I said, it's time to move. So we're going to sell this house. She said, don't sell it. Use this for your ministry. No, we need funding. We need furniture. She said, what about all the money we don't need to live on from the cleaning service only? Because we work full-time jobs.
Right.
And we had a cleaning service. She said, why not use that money? And so that brought in the life of what we talk about now, which is mending hearts.
Yeah.
Yep.
Wow. It started such a, I mean, like many things start so simple and so pure.
Yes.
But what I just love is how eloquently you explained the thought process of listing out the things that you saw so important as the essentials. And what I was seeing is just the heart behind the matter, because it was lived experience you were pulling from, knowing this is what is going to meet the needs and touch the hearts of women and make a real actual difference to break a cycle.
Yes. And you know, Patrick, as women, you know, addiction is addiction, right?
Yeah.
But if you look at our statistics, women use less drugs than men, right? But the effects of the drugs are more impactful, even that it's a lesser substance, right?
Mm.
But also, one of the things when you think about a woman in using drugs is women are already bogged down with a weight of life. If you think about a woman and what she does on a daily basis, if she has a family, right, she not only try to care for herself, right, but she neglects herself. I mean, continuously, right? Yeah. She neglects herself because she got to put her husband first, the kids. She's got to maintain the house. She's got to make sure clothes clean. It's just some, when you come home, when the mate comes home, they generally dump on the partner.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's a woman married to a male counterpart, right, he usually comes home and just unloads, right? The kids, mommy.
Mm-hmm.
If you got two or three, think about that.
Yeah.
And don't have one with a disability or a mental illness.
Yeah.
Then it's double the work. Well, she takes all that. And then if she's got a job too, look how much she's weighing. I mean, how much she's toting.
Yes.
And so my job and my goal is to always think, how can we lighten the load of a woman's process to recovery?
Mm.
And some of the things that I'm grateful about Mending Hearts is that we're not just housing women. You know, I went to a program and I'm grateful that they brought me in,
mm-hmm.
because being openly gay, I got turned away, but there was that one program that took me.
Yeah.
And I'm grateful, right? And they also judged me because of my prior lifestyle. And they didn't think that I had change in me. And so I'm grateful for that. But as the women walk through the doors of Mending Hearts, I always tell the team, when that woman comes through the door, no matter what she looks like, smell like, how she's dressed, what her economic status is, or what her sexuality is, it doesn't matter. When she walks through that door, you're looking at Trina, right? Because I could have been either one of those, and I have been most of those women. Whether it was my mental illness off, whether it was my addiction run rapid, whether I smelled bad, because I ain't always looked like this.
Mm.
It was weeks at times that I walked these streets not taking a bath.
Sure.
You know, so I understand the process. But when I see those women, Patrick, I see me, I see hope, and I believe. And so when they come through the doors, I don't only want to shelter them. One of my greatest gifts, I think, that was given to me is Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I can shelter them, I can feed them and I can bathe them, I can get them to see that glimpse of hope. Because they start to believe, oh, I feel better, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then they start to build core relationships with other people. They get their social life back, and it don't have to be with drugs. And so behind that, though, we get to start seeing the other elements. We get to see the mental illness. We get to see some of the physical elements. We get to see some of the diseases we picked up. You know, we've neglected our bodies in such a way now that when we start to heal, you know, when we're doing drugs, you know, you have pain that you don't realize you have because it's covered behind the addiction. But when you stop using, that's why they have detox now, right? And so we have a medical detox, and we want to be able to bring these women in. We don't care if you're pregnant, you know, whether you're not pregnant. We don't care if you have a mental illness. We want to treat the woman. And we don't want to use a cookie cutter system. And what I mean by that is that in our 28-day treatment program, you'll be in the same group. But guess what? Your process of recovery will change. You may not need Ray Sachs' help with your sexual trauma, right? We might can get you into a one-on-one counselor in-house. But there are other women that may need to step outside the program and get some outside help because the damage was so bad. And so as we continue, I've come to grips with that I just didn't want to be a 30-day program. I knew it took me 2 years. It's now taken me 27 years, right, to continue this way of life.
Wow.
So if we can help a woman come through the doors and give her a welcome and a stay and let her know that you have up to 2 years to recover. Now, the average stay is 6 months, 6 to 9 months. We have a couple in there a little over a year. But, you know, I believe in long-term recovery.
Me too. Yeah. That's beautiful. And, I, you know, with how grateful I am that Mending Hearts and the, you know, their some other places that do some, you know, work around the similar goal, even with that, we can't have enough. I mean, like, you know, this, the need is still, we're never, I don't know that we could ever fill
this, the, what we're dealing with today, we do not have enough services. And there's a pillar of services out here. You know, our sister programs, I love Thistle Farms, the next door, Renewal House, right? I love these we have some more younger sister programs coming up that I'm excited about that I engage in and get involved in because I don't believe that Mending Hearts has the secret sauce, right? And so Mending Hearts is partnering not only with the nonprofit agencies, but with the for-profit agencies. I think there's a corner for everyone.
Absolutely.
We're in partnership with Meharry Elam. That's a whole university. Well, Trina, why would you do that? Because they have some services that we can collaborate and that can cross over to assist the woman. Because at the end of the day, it's about the woman. And you should give the woman the right to recover in which way she want to.
That's right.
And the more resources you have, the more flexibility she has to recover.
So beautiful. I think that, you know, you, as you said that, I took a pause because I was thinking and reflecting about how you so beautifully laid out the way many women are pulled on, like you said, at home and in many different ways, work, double job, spouse coming home, you know, whatever. And the way that you're talking about helping to heal is saying, we're going to bring all that back from all the different directions because it can't just be one. No. You've been pulled on from so many different directions for so long.
Yes. Yes.
That just touched my heart.
Thank you, Bridget. Way.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's one of the things that, I think in our society today is that I pray, Patrick, is that the woman can heal enough so that she can go back to our dining room table. That's a big one for me. I don't get to do it as often as I like anymore because I'll have all adult children, right?
Yeah.
And so I've been blessed now with two grandkids, well, really five, because my bonus child has three, and she gave me my first three. And I get to see them twice a year, and we FaceTime. My son has a son, and my daughter, who had the heart condition, just delivered a baby girl. She's still over in the NIC unit. She just reached 4 pounds. And so I want families to get back to the dining room table.
Yeah.
And Trina, why the dining room table? If you can think of, Patrick, even in your holiday seasons, when you go to grandma's house, right? That's where you do all the catching up. That's where you get all the news flash.
Yep.
That's where all the tea comes out.
That's right.
And you're eating good and you're filling the soul. And not only are people pouring into you, but you're pouring out. And you're really opening up and dialoguing about who you are today, mm-hmm. right? And so if you think about families coming in, the kids coming in from school, if they could come back in and join at the dining room table at night, opposed to Uber and going back to their rooms and eating McDonald's and playing the video games, if we could come back to the dining room table, I think families would identify an early onset of possible upcoming addictions.
Mm.
You would hear Natalie say, Mama, I'm concerned about Ashley. You know, she's avoiding me, or when I seen her in the gym today, she was just laying over sleeping. Rumor has it that she's taking these Skittles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could have some of those conversations. Mom, in turn, could educate her daughter
right.
not to. And maybe, hey, do you feel comfortable going to the guidance counselor? You know, or if it's Johnny who broke his arm and, you know, he's playing sports, but like he can't do what he do without the medication anymore.
Yep.
And so if we could get back to the table, I think more of those conversations would come and we could address them head on.
Mm.
But I think one of our issues is the pride, right?
Mm. Speak.
We just don't want the stigma that's on addiction.
That's right.
Today
yep.
is that we don't want people to know that we have an illness, you know. But if we look across the country, it's in every family,
mm-hmm.
and you're not going to miss it. And it doesn't make you the bad person because you identified it. What makes you bad is that you want to keep it tucked away.
Mm.
And you did not give this person this disease. You didn't go to Kroger's and say,
right.
let me buy an addiction, right? But you need to track it and figure out where did it come from? Did it come from granddaddy or did it come from grandma? Could have came from both,
mm-hmm.
right? One of the beautiful things I'm grateful for is that I was able to talk to my kids, but that came through therapy. Trina's not that brilliant, right?
I don't know. I might beg to differ.
It came through therapy to be able to open up and tell them my true, authentic self,
yeah.
right? And to be able to share with them, you know, my barriers. And they were able to accept me for who I am. And they don't mind telling the story now. And somebody can come and say, Mama, such and such, you used to do such and such. And I said, I don't remember, but let's just say it happened.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Because it's possible.
Uh-huh.
I'm not going to say I didn't. But what you can tell them is, I don't know, but she probably did. That was my mama back then.
Mm.
It's not her today. You know,
one
of the other gifts I'm blessed for is that, you know, I tell people all the time is that we as human beings have to be respectful of our ancestors, right?
Mm-hmm.
Good and bad. Because I know that my addiction came from my father. I know that my mom would take a quart, fifth, or whatever, and it would last her months at a time. I see my mom drunk one time, and she was coming from a company Christmas party.
Mm.
And her boss and her boss's boss is who brought her home.
Wow.
And now her boss was wobbling too, and the two people out of the car had to come and get her. But I thought it was beautiful that they cared enough
mm-hmm.
to bring my
mm-hmm.
mom home,
mm-hmm.
you know. And back then, that was the era when we were in a more racist society than we
right.
are today.
Yeah.
And my mom and there was three other black women out of 100 people were at this big Christmas party.
Yeah.
And, you know, she felt comfortable enough to get loose and let her hair down. And that was the first time I ever seen her drunk. Now, my father, my vision of him, he always drank.
Mm-hmm.
There were liquor bottles all around. And so I know from my mama's story,
mm-hmm.
That's where my addiction transpired. And so I think that families need to go back and track.
Absolutely. You know?
And we're not just talking about alcohol and substance, right?
Oh, no.
We're talking about the mental illness.
Yeah.
You know, we can track some of this. And what does mental illness look like today? It's not what most people thought of as, and I hate to use this word, and I used it at one of my events, and somebody reminded by it, but when we look at mental illness, most people look at mental retardation. Mm. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the anxiety and the depression that keeps you from getting up, doing your normal duties, mm-hmm. right? We're talking about the lack of speech.
Right.
We're talking about some of those emotional elements that keep you suffering. Mm. And so we gotta bring that thing to life. And we've got to put it out here on billboards.
That's right.
It's okay to be okay, mm. right? It's okay to take your medicine.
Yeah.
See, people think when you take medication that people are going to look at you like, hey, you're sick. No, you're sick when you don't take the meds.
That's right.
And so,
and sometimes it's not forever. Sometimes it's just a bridge to help you get to a place of stabilization.
Yes. You know, I had to take medications for a long time. In jail, I literally told a lie so I could sleep my time away. But I got dependent on that medication. And it was trazodone, right? Mm-hmm. I got dependent on it. And when I came off of it, when you looked at me, man, I was so big. You know, they don't give you fresh vegetables in jail, right? So you're not getting that nice salad, right? If you get some green peas, you got to make sure they're really peas, right? And so one of the things, we ate Zuzus and Wham Whams all the time. I went in probably 180, 200, came out 450.
Wow.
Right? And so what I do know is that the medication I really needed, mm-hmm. I never signed up for, right? But after I got out and I was in recovery for about a year, one of the things about that program is that they gave me the ability to see a therapist while I was in treatment. And so I was able to carry that out. I got to see a psychiatrist. And today, off and on, I don't do therapy regular, mm-hmm. but there's points in my life. You know, I went through a divorce over 4 years ago. It was time to see the therapist.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because you can't look like you're strong because you're out here running a company or an agency.
That's right.
And you're going across the country sharing the message of recovery, right? Because I travel often, probably once or twice a month, speaking about recovery, right? And so people look upon you and put you up here when, like, you got some real issues down here, right? And they see this picture of you, but is that you? And so I had to address a lot of internal stuff. Mm-hmm. And I remember going off the grid. You know, I had to get totally off the grid.
Absolutely.
And so take care of Trina, you know. And there are things that come across. I still have sponsorship in my life. And every now and then, guess what? I go on a retreat, right?
Heck,
because I need somewhere to dump.
Right? Yeah.
And so for me, that's part of my healing process. And you can't continue to give if you don't have anything to give.
That's absolutely right.
So where's your tank at?
Speaking of tanks and giving, we cannot go on and end this without talking about this gift that you've been able to give, aside from what we've talked about, but this most recent thing, your book, and talking about your story. What's the name of it? And it's out now, right?
Yes.
Okay.
It is out. It is The Flight to Freedom. Mm. And, you know, the reason it's called The Flight to Freedom, if you think about the journey that you go on, you're on this ride, right?
Yeah.
And I am at, there's a passage in this 12-step process called The Broader the Base, mm-hmm. The Higher the Point of Freedom. And so for me, because I've been connected to all the resources, right, I get this flight to freedom.
Yeah.
Right. And my journey of facing these barriers, right, have become to blessings. Mm. And so it's The Flight to Freedom, from barriers to blessings. And Barnes and Noble has it. You can go on my website, TrinaFrierson.com, and buy it there. But all the locals, wherever you can buy a book at, you should be able to buy that book.
Perfect.
Yes.
We're going to have it linked in the show notes as well. So people
please,
can
I would love
follow along on all your things and find your book as well. And all the lovely things about Mending Hearts too. Gosh, I want to thank you so much for being so vulnerable and sharing. I mean, I know that you talk all the time, but this has been a special treat. And I hope and I know that this is going to go on and affect countless lives.
Well, that's because that's what you do, Patrick.
Well,
you're listen, you are the plug.
And, I'm a conduit. I'm trying to be, but,
yeah,
you know.
But listen, you're plugging into the juice, and people get to plug into that.
Yeah.
And so just your spirit and enlightening and enhancing and empowering people in recovery from the recovery process. And whether that's recovery and addiction, recovery from mental illness, recovering from cancer, this is just a beautiful thing that you are doing to enlighten our community mm-hmm. at large. And so I'm honored to be here with you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mutual. The yes. feeling is mutual. Oh my gosh. Last thing I want to ask you is, you know, what piece of encouragement would you like to end on for the person that has really identified with your story today?
You know, whether that's a family member, a mother of a child, a person themselves, please find your local resources. There's always a hotline. Listen, whether they call you, me, or our national website or our local website, be able to talk to somebody. You don't have to sit in the group or the classroom or the work settings, but find that someone, somebody that you can talk to and tell. And just know, no matter what your economic status is, there's a program that'll fit you.
That's right. That's good.
Yep.
That's good. Thank you again, Trina Frierson.
Thank you.
The one and only. Thank you all for sticking around for this episode. I'm so glad that you did. And I'm going to end on the note that I always do, because I think it's so important, and say that it is never, ever too late to start loving yourself. And you're always only one decision away from a completely different life.
Yes. Thank you, Patrick.
Thank you.
It's a blessing.
This podcast is brought to you by Promises Behavioral Health. If you or a loved one are struggling with trauma, addiction, or mental health, we are ready to answer your questions and help you take that next step. Call our admission center at 888-648-4098 or visit us online at www.promises.com. Our team is ready and waiting to answer the call for help.